And thank you, OUL, for having me back. This is, I think, maybe my third time speaking with this group. I did a presentation about my book, Urban Nightmares, years ago when this group used to meet at the New World Resource Center over in Humboldt Park. Before you had a camera, right. Just to clarify, I'm on the executive committee of the Illinois State Conference of the AAUP, which is a conference of all of the chapters, all of the AAUP chapters in the state of Illinois. I was also a founding member and past president of North Central College's AAUP chapter. So let me start by simply stating my thesis, which I don't think for this group is particularly controversial. Higher education in the United States of America is under attack, and it is a dual-pronged attack. On the one hand, colleges and universities are increasingly being targeted by a concerted and relentless public relations and ideological campaign by conservatives seeking to discredit progressive, anti-capitalist, and radical scholars in the academy, and also to discredit progressive, radical, feminist, critical race theorists, and so on, and at the same time to kind of promote their own kind of right-wing ideology, right? So on the one hand, there's this concerted ideological and PR campaign against colleges and universities. At the same time, higher education in this country, like so many public services, is coping with decades of bipartisan fiscal austerity, right? Decades of what this group will recognize as neoliberalism, right? A program of subordinating public goods and public services to the merciless logic of the marketplace, even in cases of kind of nominally public institutions, running, increasingly structuring and managing colleges and universities like businesses, right? And it's not a coincidence that these two attacks on higher education, a sort of fiscal and economic attack on higher education and an ideological attack on higher education, are occurring at the same time. It's not a coincidence that the casualization of the university workforce, the attack on the rights of faculty unions, dramatic cuts to government financial support for higher education coincide with this ideological campaign to discredit higher education as a sort of biased hotbed of liberalism. And though it has not been as visible or as well publicized as the right's ideological attacks on the supposed liberalism of the academy, the economic assault, the bipartisan economic assault on state support for post-secondary education has actually been part of a coordinated campaign, one that is funded and led by many of the same exact organizations and wealthy individuals who are behind the ideological assault on higher education. In this presentation, then, I would like to explore this twin assault on higher education in the U.S., examine who is behind it, and maybe, if I have time at the end, discuss what I think we could possibly do to resist it. Let me just start with what is probably most familiar to most people in this room, namely the ideological attack against liberals and radicals in the academy. In the past few years, if you have been following the news, you know that conservatives have stepped up their attack against what they claim is widespread suppression of free speech and intellectual freedom at colleges and universities around the country. And they think this attack on free speech and intellectual freedom is being carried out primarily by the left inside the academy. I think that's demonstrably false, but that is their claim. Campus Republicans, Republican groups at one school after another, have delighted in inviting noxious white supremacists and Islamophobic speakers like Milo Yiannopoulos, who you might remember, caused a riot when he was invited to University of California, Berkeley, a couple of years ago, Ann Coulter, Charles Murray, and others. They've delighted in inviting speakers like Yiannopoulos, Coulter, and others to campus so that they can scold student progressives for their intolerance, right, in the wake of the boisterous protests that predictably follow these invitations. Right-wing media outlets, many of them fairly new, like Campus Reform, The College Fix, and Breitbart News, routinely highlight stories about the censoriousness and the repressiveness of college administrators and student activists, and attack progressive faculty for the left-wing bias, quote-unquote, of their scholarship and teaching. And recent years have also witnessed the proliferation of conservative student organizations, although exactly what leadership role students play in these organizations is an open question. Conservative student organizations like Turning Point USA, who devote a lot of their time to monitoring and then smearing progressive faculty and fomenting outrage over the political correctness that is allegedly running amok on college campuses. Turning Point USA, for those of you who aren't familiar with it, is an outfit that maintains a watch list of liberal faculty members who are alleged to have discriminated against conservatives or have been guilty of liberal bias in some way. But it's not just these kind of, it's not just student groups and campus Republican groups that have been kind of fomenting this ideological attack against the academy. More recently, since Trump's election, the Department of Justice has gotten into the act. So in his now notorious September 26, 2017 speech at Georgetown Law School, Attorney General Jeff Sessions made the claim that, quote, freedom of thought and speech on American campuses on the American campus are under attack, and that higher education in the U.S. had become, quote, an echo chamber of political correctness. And the Justice Department, on the very same day that Sessions made this speech at Georgetown Law School, reiterated some of Sessions' claims in making a, quote, unquote, statement of interest in a lawsuit concerning the alleged violation of First Amendment rights at Georgia Gwinnett College, which was a college that had shut down a Christian fundamentalist student who was engaged in some very aggressive street preaching, was supposedly harassing students as they were on the quad. And a lawsuit was filed by a Christian law firm, basically alleging that his First Amendment rights had been violated. And the Justice Department took the unprecedented step of filing essentially a statement of interest, which is sort of like an amicus brief, in support of the lawsuit against Georgia Gwinnett College. More recently, Sessions' Justice Department has sued the University of Michigan to overturn its anti-bias policies, claiming that those policies have had a chilling effect on political speech, presumably the political speech of political racists. But nevertheless, they have filed suit to challenge the University of Michigan's anti-bias policies. So you've got this unprecedented involvement of the Department of Justice in campus free speech fights, where the Department of Justice is actively siding with the organized forces of the right to attack higher education. But perhaps even more concerning is what Republican legislatures around the country are doing. Republican state legislatures in Arizona, in Georgia, in North Carolina have in the past 18 months or so passed so-called campus free speech laws that were based on a model piece of legislation promoted by the Goldwater Institute that calls for very severe penalties for student demonstrators who, quote, disrupt the free speech of others. It's kind of an Orwellian, these acts are always called campus free speech laws or campus free speech acts, but it's a kind of Orwellian title for the legislation because what the legislation does is provide for very severe penalties, such as expulsion, for students who engage in boisterous protest that might target, say, right-wing speakers. So not only is this now law in Arizona, Georgia, and North Carolina, but in a number of states where Republicans dominate the state legislature, universities have adopted this policy as official university policy. So at the University of Wisconsin and in the University of Wisconsin system, where Republican Governor Scott Walker has appointed a number of the members of the Board of Regents, they have adopted this policy as an official policy, every civil liberties organization who's analyzed it suggests is going to have a very chilling effect on campus protest because they don't exactly define what disruption entails and what disrupting the free speech of others might entail. So perhaps just protesting outside of the building where Ann Coulter or Milo Yiannopoulos is speaking could constitute disruption and be a black mark against a student and ultimately lead to expulsion. So let me just give you a little bit of background on these sorts of ideological attacks on higher education. I imagine most people in this room know that none of this is particularly new. The accusation that colleges and universities are breeding radicals or they're hotbeds of sedition has been around for quite a long time. For example, if you go back to the 1930s, there was a famous case that took place here in Chicago, where Walgreen, the founder of the Walgreen drug chain, his niece was a student at the University of Chicago. And he learned that his niece had been assigned as a text in class the Communist Manifesto. And he was immediately outraged, that she was being required to read the Communist Manifesto in sort of a survey of Western political thought. And so he put pressure on the state legislature to do something about it. And a series of hearings were held at the University of Chicago into the question of whether or not the curriculum at the University of Chicago was promoting communism or was promoting subversive ideas. Robert Hutchins, who was then the president of the University of Chicago, is a great champion of academic freedom, spoke fairly eloquently for the need for students to read texts like the Communist Manifesto. But suffice it to say, it was front page news here in Chicago, and there were certain conservative newspapers in Chicago, like the Chicago Tribune, who kind of covered it relentlessly and fomented the threat of Reds at the University of Chicago. There's some if people are interested, I can refer you to some very interesting historical articles about this, you know, the Walgreens anti-communist inquiry at the University of Chicago. Of course, during the Cold War, the McCarthy period, similar accusations were routinely made, right, about faculty that they harbored communist sympathies or left-wing sympathies. And again, here in Chicago, the Chicago Tribune was one of the leaders in calling out what they saw as, pinko and red professors who were preaching seditious ideas. In fact, they ran a whole series in the 1950s where they were highlighting un-American professors. Of course, this is not surprising given that the publisher of the Chicago Tribune at the time, Robert McCormick, thought that Joe McCarthy would make a good president, right? And actually, on the editorial pages of the Tribune was promoting McCarthy as a presidential candidate. So it's maybe not shocking that they did a whole series on communist subversion at colleges and universities. And then, of course, in the 1960s, when, especially in kind of the mid to late 1960s, there was a big uptick in student activism on campus. You had students getting involved with the civil rights movement, and then heavily involved in groups like the Students for a Democratic Society. Began organizing against the war in Vietnam, and students were generally more politicized and demanding more of a say in higher education. That's kind of the sort of key moment, I think, when conservatives became, as a group, increasingly alarmed, right, that colleges and universities were breeding grounds for dissident ideas that they disapproved of. If any of you have read or are familiar with Nancy MacLean's Democracy in Chains, and if you haven't, I encourage you strongly to take a look at it. One of the things that she argues there is that it's at this moment, right, the late 1960s, that conservatives make up their mind that as a group, that they need to have engage in a concerted cultural war, right, to push back against the hegemony, what they saw as the hegemony or the dominance of left-wing ideas, especially left-wing and liberal ideas, especially in the academy. And she points in the book, and many other historians point to the Lewis Powell's 1971 memo for the U.S. Chamber of Commerce as a kind of pivotal moment in that history. So for those of you who are not familiar with Lewis Powell, he was a very well-connected corporate lawyer from Richmond, Virginia. He sat on the board of dozens of large companies, including cigarette maker Philip Morris. And he was very concerned, personally, about the threats to corporate power and to kind of elite power posed by the various social movements of the 1960s. He was, in the early 70s, commissioned by his close friend and the director of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, Eugene Sindor, to write a special memo about how the quote-unquote business community, and I just love that term, business community, about how the business community should respond to the threats posed by the increased activism of the 1960s. And in the 1,500-word kind of document that he produced, entitled, quote, Attack on American Free Enterprise System, Powell delineated a blueprint for corporate elites for ways that corporate elites could re-exert their influence over American culture. And Powell urged the captains of industry and commerce to, quote, wage guerrilla warfare against those seeking to weaken their power, and especially urged them to become to focus on and attempt to exert influence over institutions that he identified as shaping U.S. public opinion: academia, the media, churches, and the courts, right? He identified those institutions as kind of formative of U.S. public opinion, and he urged you know, the captains of industry, who were almost all, you know, conservative, to take efforts to control political debate by, for example, shaping the content of textbooks. And he argued that trustees and donors to higher education should demand an increased say in things like university hiring and an increased control over college curriculums, right? Because you know, that's how they would ultimately exert kind of formative influence over U.S. public opinion. And he counseled corporate America, the members of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, right? All Fortune 500 companies, very wealthy institutions, very wealthy individuals, to pony up lots and lots of money in a coordinated effort to accomplish the goals that he had laid out. Now, it would be conspiratorial to say, you know, that this blueprint, it was because he wrote this blueprint that the attacks on higher education that we're witnessing today have followed necessarily. I'm not a believer in conspiracy theories, but I think he was articulating ideas that were in the air among elites in American society, and much of what he has urged has kind of come to pass. And so it's not an accident, I don't think, that in the past few decades, in the decades since the writing of the Powell Memo, we have witnessed wave after wave of assaults on higher education. In the 1980s and 90s, there were a legion of right-wing commentators like Alan Bloom and Robert Kimball and Dinesh D'Souza who argued that higher education in America was being destroyed by something they called multiculturalism. By the fact that English teachers were teaching works by people of color and women, that this was somehow an assault on Western civilization and something needed to be done about it. A few years after that, David Horowitz, former radical turned reactionary, founded a group called Students for Academic Freedom that had as its expressed goal to promote intellectual diversity within colleges and universities as a counter to what he argued was the liberal orthodoxy on college campuses, right? So the ideological assault that higher education is currently facing is, I'm trying to say, not exactly new. But what is new, I think, is how well-funded, how well-coordinated this attack is this time. What's new is that up until fairly recently, there was not what there is now, which is a well-oiled right-wing outrage machine that consists of dozens of groups who are focused on infusing conservative ideas into the academy and policing and disciplining left-wing or radical students and left-wing or radical faculty. And these groups, and I'm going to talk about them in a little bit more detail in just a second, these groups have developed a symbiotic relationship with the corporate mass media, and in particular, the somewhat more conservative corporate mass media, like Fox News and the Wall Street Journal, so that they function as a kind of monitoring system that alerts Fox News and the Wall Street Journal to cases of right wing of left wing bias or left wing censorship that they can then amplify and broadcast and use to discredit and tarnish higher education. Let me just run through, because I'm looking at the time here and I don't want to go on way too long. Let me just run through very quickly some of the agencies of right-wing influence on campus. I'm just going to list a few. So there's the American Council of Trustees and Alumni, which is a group of conservative donors to higher education and trustees. There's Accuracy in Academia, which is a somewhat older organization. There's the Alliance Defending Freedom. There's the Canary Mission, which specifically targets anti-Zionist faculty. There's the David Horowitz Freedom Center, formerly known as the Center for the Study of Popular Culture, which is David Horowitz's personal kind of agency of right-wing influence on campus. There are all the campus wings of the Federalist Society, which is the conservative group that operates at law schools. There's the Intercollegiate Studies Institute, the Institute for Humane Studies at George Mason University, which is funded almost entirely by the Koch brothers. There's the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, formerly known as the Pope Center in North Carolina. There's the Leadership Institute, which is the publisher of a very influential online publication focused exclusively on higher education called Campus Reform. There's the Mercatus Center, also at George Mason University. There's the National Association of Scholars. There's the Student Free Press Association, which is the publisher of another online publication called called College Fix. There's Turning Point USA, Young Americans for Freedom, and then there's a couple of organizations that it's hard to classify as strictly right wing, although they tend to be somewhat more fairly libertarian and tend to line up with the right on a lot of issues. There's FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, and Heterodox Academy. That's 17 right organizations, all of whom are devoted either entirely or at least in part to exerting a kind of right-wing ideological influence on campus that are self-identified as either libertarian or conservative. And this doesn't include all those very well-funded conservative think tanks who dominate policymaking in Trump era Washington, D.C., and whose work supports the research and writing of conservative scholars and intellectuals like the American Enterprise Institute, the Cato Institute, Heritage Foundation, and so on. And it doesn't include all of the regional right-wing think tanks like the Goldwater Institute, which is based in Arizona, who sometimes intervene on educational policy issues and speak out about the state of higher education. This is an elaborate network designed to influence the national debate and national perceptions, right, of higher education. And each of these entities has, over the years, received very generous financial support from the personal foundations of assorted right-wing billionaires and millionaires. The Charles Koch Foundation, the Bradley Foundation, the Dick and Betsy DeVos Foundation, and yes, that is a foundation that is the personal foundation of our current education secretary, Betsy DeVos, the Scaife Foundation, and so on. For instance, I'm just going to give you a couple of examples. The David Horowitz Freedom Center, the group that funds David Horowitz's efforts to smear left-wing academics in books like 100 Dangerous Academics. It's a scintillating read. Between 2000 and 2018, received 60 separate donations from the Lynn and Harry Bradley Foundation, totaling close to $5 million. The Intercollegiate Studies Institute, which among other things provides money for students at American universities to publish alternative newspapers for conservative and libertarian undergraduates. When I was a student at the University of Wisconsin. The Intercollegiate Studies Institute provided funding for a right-wing paper on our campus. The Intercollegiate Studies Institute, in the same period, received $8.2 million from the DeVos Urban Leadership Institute, the family foundation of Trump Education Secretary Betsy DeVos, and another $7.9 million in contributions from the Sarah Scaife Foundation. Turning Point USA, the campus free market activist group behind the notorious professor watch list that I mentioned before, is based here in the Chicago area, actually out in, out in Lombard. And they had an annual budget of $5 million back in 2016. It receives a lot of its funding from Chicago area conservative Republican donors. So, for instance, Richard Yulian, who doled out $23.7 million in campaign contributions to Republicans in 2017, through his family foundation, gave Turning Point USA $175,000 in 2017. Our current governor, Bruce Rauner, who has proposed massive funding cuts for higher education in each of his budgets, gave Turning Point USA $150,000 in 2015, and the group has also received support from the Bradley Foundation and the DeVos Foundation. Okay, I could go on and on and on, but the money makes a difference, and let me just illustrate why it makes a difference by talking about just briefly some of the right-wing, these new right-wing online publications that are focused on kind of drawing attention to and smearing progressive and left-wing faculty. So let's take, for example, Campus Reform. Let me ask, how many of you have ever heard of Campus Reform? Not very many of you. If you're not in higher education, you may never have encountered them. But they're published by a group called the Leadership Institute, which is based in Washington, D.C., founded by the former executive director of the College Republicans, a guy by the name of Morton Blackwell. And its ostensive aim is to train conservatives for careers in government. Blackwell launched the Campus Reform, this website, as a social network in 2009 and decided to turn it into a quote-unquote news site in 2011, and its stated aim is to, quote, expose the liberal bias and abuse against conservatives at America's colleges and universities and to monitor and report what it calls, quote, leftist indoctrination on college campuses. But much of its focus is on drawing attention to outrageous, quote-unquote, outrageous and controversial statements made by progressive faculty or students. Often these statements that are reported in their various articles are taken completely out of context so as to provoke, right, outrage and controversy. For instance, it was Campus Reform that first brought to the right-wing media's attention Drexel political science professor Chicharello Maher, who made a joking, you may remember he was a Drexel political science professor, and made a joking tweet, about saying that all he wanted for Christmas was white genocide, right? And it was very clearly presented, if you looked at the tweet, in the context of all of his tweets, as a joke. It was clearly tongue-in-cheek. It was a mocking jab at the alt-right's paranoid fantasies, right, about the coming white genocide. And he was very clearly mocking and trolling the alt-right. And yet, Campus Reform ran dozens of articles, first about the tweet itself, and then that provoked a backlash and provoked a controversy, which became a national controversy, thanks in part to Campus Reform's coverage, and then they covered the controversy that they had helped to spark. It also was notorious for publicizing University of Iowa classics professor Sarah Bond's comments about the alt-right's misappropriation of ancient Greek statues. She is a scholar of ancient Greece, and she, in a blog post, argued that the alt-right, which was using white marble ancient Greek statues as symbols in a lot of their literature and a lot of their websites, and she was arguing that they were misappropriating these statues because the statues themselves were originally painted. and in often cases, painted with olive paint, olive-colored, or even dark brown and black paint, because the people who lived in the ancient world were very likely did not look like contemporary Northern Europeans, and so she was accusing them of misappropriating classical art for their ideological purposes. Campus Reform latched on to her blog post, and then it blew up into another huge controversy. It got national coverage, and she received death threats as a result, probably from some of these right-wing activists. Campus Reform and the Leadership Institute get their money, right, get their funding from the same people who fund these other, all the other institutions and groups and so forth in this network of right-wing influence. According to its most recent I-90 form, it had the Leadership Institute had a budget of $14.5 million in 2016, and it claimed total assets of $25 million, and most of its funding has come from various kinds of right-wing foundations. So the Donors Trust, which Nancy McLean argues is sort of a money laundering operation for big right-wing foundations, so that it is a trust that receives funding from groups like the Koch brothers, so that they can kind of cleanse their name, right, from the money. The Donors Trust gave the Leadership Institute, Campus Reform's publisher, $1.1 million in the past 10 years. The Bradley Foundation gave $875,000. The right-wing Mueller Foundation chipped in $500,000. The Kochs themselves gave about $70 million apiece, and the DeVos Foundation gave $70 million. Okay. So I guess the question you have to ask, because I need to move on to the other parts of it, I could talk more about this because I've done extensive research on who these people are who are publishing these various publications targeting the left in the academy. But the thing you have to ask is, why would they spend so much money on this? Why? Why spend so much money on it? It goes back to this idea that very clearly the right sees themselves as engaged in an ideological war, right, for the hearts and minds, right, of America, and they think that higher education is an important battlefield in which to wage the war of ideas. And I think you need to ask yourself, if you look to the on the left, whether those of us on the left, right, have a commensurate set of institutions, and the answer is no, right? There's not a vast network of progressive or radical groups who are getting millions and millions of dollars from foundations whose sole purpose is to promote left-wing ideas on campus. Right. In fact, the unions have given up even funding labor education programs. they've backed off of funding labor education programs, which directly serve their members, much less expending millions of dollars on a war of ideas And so this is sort of a one-sided war. On the one hand, you have the Koch brothers and the DeVosses and other right-wingers spending, you know, tens of millions of dollars to influence debate on college campuses. And on the other hand, right, you have the left spending next to nothing. Go ahead, yeah. Yes, I think there's, you're absolutely right. Thank you for drawing out that point, because yes, there's some
nothing guerrilla about this.
There's nothing. This is like a frontal assault. They've gone from guerrilla to frontal, although they still take steps, right, to disguise themselves. And I actually had a friend, I'm sorry to go off on a tangent here. I had a friend when I was reporting to him on the research that I had done about, you know, this network of influence on campus, who said, well, why do the Koch brothers bother to, like, you know, fund all these different front groups? Why do the DeVosses fund all these different front groups? Why not just give all their money to some super mega right-wing association? And I think the answer is it would be a lot less effective, because everyone would see that it was this small little handful of right-wing billionaires who were driving things. This way, it appears as if, like, for example, Turning Point USA is a grassroots student movement, which it is not. It is they're guilty of setting up a series of AstroTurf associations. There supposedly is a Turning Point USA chapter at my school, North Central College. But as near as we can tell, it only has one student member, right? And I would be willing to bet that that's probably the case at many schools, not all, because we do know that there are certain schools where there are active chapters that have maybe 20 or 30 members. But I think at most schools where there is a Turning Point USA chapter, there's one person. They are, they are purely, they're an AstroTurf association. So by funding all these different associations, all these different organizations, they can create the illusion, right, of a groundswell of of conservatism on college campuses, and of broader support than their ideas really enjoy. I think that was my answer to my friend's question. Well, why do they do this? Why not just give all this money to just one mega, think tank, mega right wing campus group? Okay, I'm looking at the time, and so I want to move on to the second prong of the attack, and I'm sorry I've spent so much time talking about the ideological assault, because, in fact, the second prong of the attack on higher education is even more important, and that is the economic assault on colleges and universities in this country. We are living through what many commentators call the neoliberalization of higher education. Some people also call it the marketization of higher education. And what this means, first of all, is that the state and the major funder of higher education in the country are state governments. Higher education systems exist at the state level. Yes, the federal government provides federal financial aid to students, but most of the funding for higher education, for individual colleges and universities, comes directly from state governments. And if you look back really over the past 30 years, there has been a secular trend of declining state support for higher education. So just to look in the most recent, like in the past 9 years, in 2017, overall state funding in the U.S. for 2- and 4-year colleges was down $9 billion compared to 2008. Right? Over the course of 9 years, funding declined $9 billion. That's well below historic levels. Over that period, over that 9-year period, 44 of 50 states spent less per student in 2017 than they did in 2008. And the average state over that 9-year period spent 17% less per student on higher education in 2008 than in 2017. State funding for institutions of higher education today amounts to roughly 53% of the costs of teaching and instruction at these schools, compared to 80%, north of 80% back in the 1960s. So schools are trying to educate, and as some of you may know, educate more students, more high school graduates than ever before are trying to get a college education. They're trying to educate more students with less funding per student. And the way that most colleges and universities have tried to accomplish that, right, to teach more students and train more students with less resources, is by raising tuition. And so it's not an accident that at the average four-year school, tuition has increased by 35% since 2008. Right, the tuition average tuition is up 35% since 2008. Here in Illinois, the tuition increase amazingly has been less than that. It's only up 25%, which is hard to believe given all the problems we've had as a state. But tuition has increased only 25% in the last 9 years, and over the past 20 years, and I'm sure you've all heard this. Tuition has grown at all institutions, both 2 and 4 year institutions, significantly faster than the median income, right? So it's becoming increasingly difficult for families to pay that increased tuition. It wouldn't be so bad if tuition increased 35%, if median income had increased 35%, but we know that wages and incomes are stagnating or declining, right, over that period. So it is becoming increasingly difficult to pay the bill to send your kid to college. And so what do people do? What do families do? Well, we know that they turn to federal financial aid, federally guaranteed student loans, and private loans in order to pay for the rising cost of attending school. And as a consequence, student debt has skyrocketed. And I'm here to tell you that it is now approaching crisis levels. I mean, I thought it was crisis levels actually when I entered the profession, and I have been I've been teaching college classes for 20 years. So I think even when I first started out in this profession, it was at crisis levels. But it is now approaching a kind of an unthinkable levels. In 2017, the average debt of college graduates was close to $40,000, $39,500. That was up 6% from 2016. So when the average student leaves school, they're carrying about $40,000 in debt, which of course limits their ability to, right, buy a home, get credit, and so on. And it puts a lot of our college graduates behind the eight ball. And there are a significant number of college graduates, usually those from working class and low income families, that are carrying much higher debt loads when they graduate from college, which puts them at an even greater disadvantage. And today it is estimated that Americans as a whole owe $1.5 trillion in student debt. $1.5 trillion. Now, I think the total value of the American economy, and somebody could correct me if I'm wrong, is like in the neighborhood of $7 trillion, or is it $7 or $8 trillion? That's a huge percentage of our GDP. It's more than double, right, the total U.S. credit card debt. More than double the total U.S. credit card debt. And yet, it's amazing, you know, if you read a newspaper on a regular basis, you would think the most important news about colleges and universities is there are some left-wing professors who are joking about wanting white genocide for Christmas, right? When the American public is carrying $1.5 trillion in student debt. That's the real crisis. That's the issue that the media should, I would submit, be interested in and talking about and discussing, because it is a real crisis. And some projections are that by the year 2023, 40% of people who have student debt will be in default, right? Will be unable to. I mean, you actually cannot declare bankruptcy or go into default, and you can't declare bankruptcy and forgive these loans, which is one of the big problems with them, right? But 40% of people who have student loans will be unable to make their regular loan payments in just a very few years, by 2023. And that's a huge amount of loans, right? So that's a huge crisis. And I think we could, if we want to, just stop there. But there are other effects of kind of the defunding of higher education that I think it's worth paying attention to. One way that colleges and universities have tried to kind of balance the books in a climate of increasing financial austerity and declining financial resources to teach all of these students is to make use increasingly of part-time faculty who are precarious employees, right, who are hired on a course-by-course basis. And they've also attempted to kind of balance the books by hiring more full-time faculty who are not on the tenure track line. Now, what that means is, that they're not going to have the protections that tenure affords. So they're hired full-time, but they're hired on year-to-year contracts rather than, if they are tenured, having multi-year contracts and having seniority rights, which mean that the only way they can be dismissed is if the institution enters into financial crisis. But the biggest trend is this increased use of part-time per-course faculty. In 1970, only 22% of faculty at four-year colleges and universities were part-timers. Today, it's about roughly half. Roughly half of all faculty are part-time faculty. In 1970, non-tenure track faculty, part-timers and full-time renewable faculty, taught only 44% of all classes at four-year institutions. Now, they teach 70 as a group, part-timers and full-time renewable faculty teach 70% of the courses at four-year colleges. So that's another effect. And then I'll just mention in passing yet another effect of the kind of financial attack on higher education is increasingly because of the increases in tuition, right, and the increase in student debt. The public has become increasingly, I think, disaffected with public universities and public university faculty, and that has created a kind of fertile environment for right-wing politicians to launch attacks on the collective bargaining rights of faculty. So we saw this very clearly up in Wisconsin, where Scott Walker stripped away the collective bargaining rights of all faculty and graduate students, for that matter, in many of the universities up in Wisconsin. In the University of Wisconsin system, also had graduate student unions. They were able to, he was able to strip away their collective bargaining rights. There was some public outcry and there was protest, but it was considered somewhat of a popular move with a certain group of people up there because they look at the bill that they pay to send their kids to school and it seems very expensive. And so they blamed the faculty unions and they blamed the staff unions and they blamed the graduate student unions, right, for the increased cost of sending kids to school, of sending their kids to college. And so it's created this fertile environment for an assault on collective bargaining rights. And the most recent Supreme Court decision that came out this summer, Janus versus AFSCME, which affects all public sector employees, is only going to embolden right-wing politicians who want to attack faculty unions and university staff unions. Just briefly, the Janice case originated here in Illinois. It was an employee named Janice who sued because he did not want to pay the fair share bargaining fee to AFSCME. And this was instituted at the urging of Bruce Rauner's allies, right? Bruce Rauner's, you know, cronies were the ones who were behind this. And some of these groups that he's affiliated with gave a lot of money to bring this case all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. And the question was, whether or not it was a violation of the First Amendment rights of this employee, this guy Janice, to have to pay a fair share fee for AFSCME to bargain his contract. He already had the right to withhold a certain amount of union, of what would be normal union dues that might go to political activities, right? So he wasn't being compelled to fund, Democratic Party candidates, right? Or AFSCME spending on political campaigns. He was not being compelled to pay for that. What he was being compelled to pay for was the bargaining, right, that the union did on his behalf to negotiate his contracts and his contract and benefits. And yet the Supreme Court said that that fair share fee that he was paying was compelled speech and as a result was a violation of his First Amendment rights. I can tell you that the AAUP, which has in many areas, has chapters who are collective bargaining agents, is very concerned about this, right? Because the estimate is that maybe up to a third of faculty will elect not to pay fair share. Something like a third of the faculty are represented by the chapters of the AAUP that are collective bargaining agents pay fair share. And they're very concerned that this could lead to the destruction of a number of faculty unions, that the unions won't have the resources they need to organize effectively to represent the interests of faculty. Okay, I see that we're kind of out of time. I was going to talk specifically about the financial situation here in Illinois that was precipitated by the budget impasse that took place between Bruce Rauner and the legislature that stretched from kind of July of 2015 through July of 2017. But I'll cut to the chase and say that Bruce Rauner refused to negotiate with the Democratic leadership in the legislature over a budget because they would not approve his so-called turnaround agenda, which among other things included limiting the rights of public employee unions and a number of other provisions. And because Democrats in the legislature would not sign off on Rauner's so-called turnaround agenda, they could not agree to a budget. And that affected all of us. I mean, anybody who lived in the state of Illinois knows that essential services were not funded, but it especially affected higher education, and institutions of higher education had to make do in a lot of cases with half or even less than half of the funding they normally would have received from the state for a couple of years. And this had a devastating impact on some of the smaller and minority-serving colleges and universities in the state. I'm thinking, for example, of NEIU, Northeastern Illinois University, here in Chicago, which is a Hispanic-serving institution, designated Hispanic-serving institution, and has one of the most diverse student populations of any university in the state. Chicago State University, which serves primarily an African-American student body. In the case of Chicago State, there was a stopgap measure that was approved, in 2016, which gave an infusion of $20 million specifically to Chicago State because it looked like Chicago State was on the verge of just being closed because of the budget impasse. But in some ways, it was too little too late, right? Even after the $20 million infusion, the Chicago State Administration laid off a lot of the non-institutional, the non-instructional employees. Something like 300 non-instructional employees were laid off. They turned off the air conditioning. They shut down all of the buildings. They ended the school year early. And that had a devastating impact on, admissions and enrollment, because very few people are going to want to send their child or kids to a school, right, where the school is being, the school year is being shortened and all of the staff are being laid off, and and you visit the campus over the summer and everything's closed, right? So, Chicago State, is still around, which is in some ways a miracle, but it is, it's struggling. Western Illinois University, which is a medium size state university with about, 8,000 undergrads, had to deal with severe budget shortfalls, was forced to trim in 2016, was forced to trim its budget by $6 million. They laid off something like 143 staff members, 30 faculty members were laid off, and in June of 2016, the Board of Trustees at Western Illinois University voted to eliminate the African American Studies program, the Philosophy program, Religious Studies, and the Women's Studies program. Now, I don't know about you, I was a philosophy major as an undergrad. I don't know how you can have a college or university that doesn't have a philosophy department, right? I just don't know how you do that. Similar situation exists at Eastern Illinois University, where in 2016 they laid off 245 staff members and 13 faculty members. Another 72 staff members took early retirement, and 43 faculty took early retirement, right? So these smaller branch campuses, which in some cases are the major employer in their communities, have just been devastated by the budget impasse. Now this year, if you've been paying attention to the news, you know that there was a budget, which is something, right? I guess we should be thankful for. And it includes some modest increases for higher education. But it doesn't really offset the 2 years, right, where colleges and universities had absolutely no idea whether they were going to get funding from the state. And this even affected schools like mine. So I'm at a private nonprofit, religiously, it's nominally a Methodist-affiliated school. And even though we're not a state institution, we depend on, to a large degree, on funds that the state makes available to students to attend our school. A lot of our students, something like 40% of our students, get what are called the Monetary Award Program grants, MAP grants. It's not a huge amount of money, right? Individual students might get a couple of $1,000 through the MAP program. But for a lot of our students, that $2,000 is the margin, is the margin of whether or not they attend school that term or not, right? So that $2,000 makes a huge amount of difference, and a lot of our students during the crisis were very nervous about whether or not they were going to be able to afford to pay their tuition bill. And fortunately, my school took some steps to ensure that even if the state did not fully fund the MAP program, that students would get money. And essentially, it would have come from our endowment, which was, I thought, a smart, savvy move on the part of our president, because otherwise we would have lost students in droves. But many private, smaller private liberal arts schools around the state, which maybe educate something like 20 to 25% of all students, higher education, college students in the state of Illinois, were facing problems as a result of the budget impasse. Okay, let me then maybe get to some conclusions and then talk about what is to be done. So, what's interesting is that if you look closely at who is behind the financial crisis facing higher education, it's the same actors who who are behind, right, the ideological campaign against higher education. It's the Koch brothers and its other right-wing donors who are funding politicians who are pushing an austerity agenda in state legislatures. They're the same exact people. The funding is coming from the same exact place. And then if you look at who is behind the Janus v. AFSCME lawsuit, groups like the National Right to Work Legal Defense Foundation, that organization, which was which represented Janus in that lawsuit, which went all the way up to the Supreme Court, gets a substantial amount of its funding from the same right-wing billionaires who are funding campus reform, College Fix, and Turning Point USA. It's the same exact people. So we're in higher education, and I think this is one of the main points that Nancy MacLean tries to drive home in her book, Democracy in Chains. We're facing a concerted war, right, against public institutions being prosecuted by these right-wing billionaires. So what do we do? And especially, what do we do now that at public colleges and universities, collective bargaining is, and unions are, on even shakier legal ground than they've been before? I would say that the way we should respond to the Janus decision and the way we should respond to the assault on higher education is, first and foremost, to organize. So faculty need to organize, students need to organize, and one way that faculty can organize is by unionizing. And I think there still is a future for faculty unions, even though the legal environment is not going to be as conducive to that today. It may be that faculty unions at public institutions will have to engage in things like striking for recognition, right, which is how unions historically gain collective bargaining rights. They went out on strike in order to get their collective bargaining rights. They didn't rely on labor law or the NLRB. They just went out on strike to compel their employers to sit down and negotiate with them, and I think that may be what we're headed towards. And I think that specifically for adjunct faculty, there's a need for trans-institutional form of labor organizing. Diana Valera, who is the president of PFAC, which is the part-time faculty union at Columbia College, and I have had conversations about the need for something like a union hiring hall for adjunct faculty, create a wage floor, and to create kind of a charter of basic rights for adjunct faculty. It works for carpenters. It works for electricians. It works for longshoremen. I think that it could actually work for faculty. And these hiring halls would maybe be organized on a regional basis. And it would create a wage floor and standardized working conditions for adjunct faculty who are among the most exploited faculty. Now, I certainly think there are exploited staff at colleges and universities too, and I would never suggest that faculty have it worse than staff. But it would create, I think, better working conditions and better wages for adjunct faculty. It's something that you could easily do, and I think a lot of, for example, I am a department chair, which means that I'm one of the people who has to sometimes hire adjunct faculty to cover classes if I don't have a regular tenured faculty member who can teach that class, or if we have too many sections. And I have a very hard time arguing with my dean and provost, on my own as a single individual department chair, that we need to pay this person more, right? They let the market decide, right? They know exactly what faculty are making, down the road at Elmhurst at Illinois Wesleyan and at Augustana, and they said, well, no, we're not going to pay a penny more than what we're paying faculty at Elmhurst or Augustana. But I think if we had some sort of union hiring hall for adjunct faculty, we could actually raise the wage floor, right, for adjuncts. And I would have leverage to argue, well, hey, you know, this is what the union hiring hall is saying is the going rate, and my provost or dean would have to agree to pay an adjunct more money. I think so. Unionization is one possible tactic for resisting. I think that, especially for faculty, more faculty have to get involved in where they don't have unions in AAUP chapters on campus, because it is a way for faculty to organize independent of administration and to speak out in defense of faculty who come under attack from organizations like Turning Point USA. We have a faculty member at North Central College who is on the professor watch list, the Turning Point USA watch list, and as in the AAUP chapter is aware of that fact, and we are prepared to respond in the event that he is targeted again by some of these right-wing groups. We have a planned response for that. Second, I think it's important for everyone who cares about this issue to educate yourself about what the right is doing, their agenda, and to expose them in every forum possible. And this is why I think Open University of the Left and organizations like it, left-wing and progressive media, are so important, because it's in venues like this that you can actually expose what these people like the Koch brothers are doing. And then third, I think it's important to bring pressure to bear on state legislators and on the State House. Now, I'm not urging people, I'm not a big believer in electoral politics, which distinguishes me from some of my other colleagues in the AAUP, because the AAUP believes in, spending money on lobbyists and things like that. I don't think that money spent on lobbyyists is all that useful, but I think if faculty get organized and students get organized and then bring pressure to bear through protest of various kinds on the state legislatures, they will respond. One of the more inspiring things that happened during the budget impasse in Springfield, when higher education was in Illinois was being starved of funding, one of the more inspirational things was student groups got together and descended en masse on the state capitol and held protests. Right, they held disruptive protests. They came from universities around the state. I know a bus came from NEIU to protest lack of funding for MAP, lack of funding for colleges and universities. And I think that, even though it was something they did maybe once or twice, is something that could be built off of, right? I think students especially, but students, faculty, and staff can join forces on this, right, and bring pressure to bear on state legislators and state houses. So those are my ideas. I know I don't have I don't have a blueprint for changing this, but thank you for your attention, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
One question I had, and I'm curious about this. I don't know, you have some feel for like what the percentages are on unionization of both, like say for example, state university employees. How large is that in secondary education,
right?
High schools and public schools? I mean, you see much larger unionization in those kind of institutions than you would in the private sector. But do you have any idea about what?
That's a really great question. I should have that number at the tip of my tongue, but I don't. I'm trying to. I mean, I think it's certainly not the level of unionization in higher education among faculty is not at the level that it is in K through 12 education, not by any stretch of the imagination, but it's on the increase. No, so I guess what I would guess, if I had to guess, it's like maybe 20%, 25%, especially if you include two-year institutions, because community college faculty tend to have much higher rates of unionization. Part of the reason for that is that for years, faculty did not think of themselves as employees, as workers. They thought of themselves essentially as management. And in fact, one of the ways that administrators have been able to resist faculty union drives is by classifying faculty as managers, right? Because we do hire, we do have like substantial control over decisions about like what we teach and so on. And so there's a famous Supreme Court decision, the Shiva decision, which made it especially hard for faculty at private institutions to unionize, because it basically said that if the school so chooses, they can classify every member of faculty, including, you know, somebody who's only like on a one-year renewable contract, as somehow a manager, right? And so, that has stood in the way of faculty unionization for years. But we have seen an uptick in faculty union drives, and the AAUP, together with the NEA, has been able to lead some really impressive drives here in Illinois. The UIC faculty unionized in Faculty United. That's a 1,000 faculty members who became a member of a union. At University of Oregon, they recently unionized. So there have been a number of victories. And partly, I think it's as a response to the neoliberalization, right, of higher education. It makes it hard for faculty to kid themselves that they're anything but workers, right? Because the administration is increasingly treating them as simply workers, right, who are interchangeable and, you know, can be hired and fired at will. And so faculty have responded by unionizing. But yeah, I think it's unionization level is I would be surprised if it was higher than 25%. And then at private institutions, it's lower, in part because of the Yeshiva decision.
Right.
I agree that the only thing that can defeat organized money is organized people. But I need to qualify that by saying even organized people need some money, need some resources. That you know, one of the problems that the left, I think, has had, especially the campus left, such as we are, is a lack of institutional continuity. And that's because, you know, we haven't built enduring institutions, because building enduring institutions requires some investment of time, but also investment of funds. And, you know, in the past, when the left had enduring institutions, the funding came from the labor movement. Let's be clear. When there was a labor movement, the labor movement bankrolled the left. And now that the labor movement has been, for all intents and purposes, decimated, and it is, you know, at the level of unionization in American society, you know, in the American economy is at its lowest point since like the 1920s, right? After the Red Scare, after all the purges, after the deportation of all the, you know, labor radicals in the 20s, it was at a very low point. We're back there right now, and we're at the exact same point. And I would argue that we're not going to be able to rebound unless the labor movement rebounds, because it's the labor movement that has always bankrolled the left, whether the left likes to admit it or not, including the civil rights movement, you name it. Every significant movement on the left has gotten some of its funding. Even it was, you know, SDS got its seed money, right, from labor unions, right? And from the AFL, God forbid, from the AFL-CIO or an AFL-CIO affiliated institution. So I think it's true, organized people beats organized money, but you also need a little bit of resources, and we are lacking that sorely.
What purchase for the left is there in the liberal arts education historically and up to today?
Can you just clarify succinctly the question that you're asking, or are you just making it?
What purchase for the left is there in the liberal arts?
In the liberal arts.
Or education,
yeah.
Historically and now.
Okay. Well, let me try to answer that. And I think you did a good job of sort of summing up, I think, you know, and I would call it kind of the dominant narrative about liberals or leftists in the academy, which is that a lot of them are former student radicals who have made the long march to the institution and ended up, right, as professors. And also, you know, I think you alluded to this notion that maybe a liberal arts education is not very, you know, practically useful, and, you know, it's not going to necessarily help someone in pursuing a career. Let me answer kind of both of those. First, I'll say
this is the wrap, by the way.
All right, we're out of time. Let me just say that I think there is this dominant narrative that the academy is saturated or overrun by liberals or radicals, and it's true that there are, if you look at opinion survey data, that people in the academy, especially in the humanities and social sciences, tend to be a lot more likely to express liberal ideas, and they're a lot more likely to say vote Democratic than vote Republican. But I don't think that necessarily makes them radicals or leftists. And very few of the people that I encounter in the academy and I've been in the academy for years, come from an activist background where they were, in fact, that, you know, you can kind of count usually on one hand people who are, you know, leftists in the academy who have actual practical activist experience. So I would to some degree discount that narrative, and I also think the narrative overlooks the fact that, you know, the growing areas of the faculty at universities in this country today are in precisely those fields, right, that are not dominated by liberals. Business schools, departments of finance and economics, engineering, medical schools, you know, the STEM fields in general. And I think if you look at, and oftentimes when these right-wing publications, right, like College Fix or Campus Reform, you know, they're publicizing the liberal or the liberal bias in college faculties, they never say anything about the STEM fields or about business schools, because that would immediately explode their narrative, right? It would reveal that, you know, my son goes to the University of Michigan. They have an enormous, gigantic business school, the Ross Business School, which my son, unfortunately, because of his major, has to take some classes in, and he views the classes that he takes there as a form of ideological indoctrination, right? Into, I mean, he's like, you know, and he also thinks they're stupid, right? They're not as challenging as like economics classes, which are like intellectually substantive, but some of the classes he has to take in the business school, he thinks are just stupid, and they're a form of indoctrination into kind of, you know, neoliberalism or kind of free market laissez-faire ideology. So I would discount to some degree that narrative, although it's certainly true for the humanities and social sciences that they tend to be more liberal. But then the question is, well then why, to get back to your point, there are fewer and fewer people studying the liberal arts, because the claim is that the liberal arts have no kind of, you know, they're not practical, they're not going to land you a job, they're not going to help you with a career. But, you know, what I would counter to that is that, you know, the education of the whole person is not just about getting a job, right? It's about living a complete and fulfilling life and being also, very importantly, an engaged citizen. And I think, you know, if one is going to be an engaged citizen, it's important to spend some time reading works of philosophy and works of philosophers like the ones that you cited, you know, taking classes like some of the ones that I teach.
Gotta put a wrap.
So thanks everyone.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it.